Picture this. It's an autumn afternoon in Paris, 1906. The chestnut trees are turning and there's a crowd gathered on a field at Bagatelle, out in the Bois de Boulogne. Ladies in long dresses, gentlemen in high collars holding their hats. And out in the middle of that field sits the strangest flying machine anybody has ever laid eyes on. It looks like it was built backward. The tail is up front, the wings are behind. It's all box kites and bamboo and piano wire, and standing up in a little wicker basket between the wings, wearing a suit and a Panama hat, is a man who barely comes up to your shoulder. Weighs about 110 pounds soaking wet. That's Alberto Santos Dumont, and in about a minute, he is going to fly. Pull up a chair. This is Radio Hangar, and you're listening to The Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and today we're not talking about a warbird or a record run across an ocean. Today we're talking about the little Brazilian dandy who taught a whole continent how to leave the ground, and who did it out in the open. In front of everybody, where nobody could say it didn't happen. Now, before we get rolling, let me tell you today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. Your first solo, your private ticket. Instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it, and every one of them tells a story. Santos Dumont never got a challenge coin. Man deserved a whole shelf of them. Go take a look at AviationSoul.com. All right, let's set the scene properly. You have to understand where the world was in the early 1900s. The Wright brothers had flown a Kitty Hawk in December of 1903. We know that now, we celebrate it now, but at the time, almost nobody in Europe believed it. The Wrights were secretive. They were two bicycle mechanics from Ohio flying out on a lonely stretch of North Carolina sand, and they weren't showing anybody. They spent years after Kitty Hawk keeping the whole thing close to the vest, trying to line up contracts before they'd let the world see what they had. So over in Europe, the general feeling was, well, the Americans are bluffing. Nobody's really flying. It can't be done. And into that doubt walks Santos Dumont. Now here's where it gets interesting. Alberto was not some struggling inventor scraping by in a rented workshop. He was the son of a Brazilian coffee baron. His father ran one of the biggest coffee plantations in the world. And young Alberto grew up driving steam tractors and locomotives around the plantation before he was even a teenager. He had a mechanical mind and, frankly, more money than most small nations. When his father's health failed, the family sold up, and Alberto took his share and moved to Paris. And in Paris, he fell in love with the sky. He started with balloons. Not just riding in them, mind you, he designed his own. A little personal balloon he called Brazil, so small the balloon makers told him it couldn't possibly work. It worked fine. And then he got restless, because a balloon goes where the wind takes it, and Alberto Santos Dumont did not care to go where the wind wanted. He wanted to steer, so he built dirigibles, powered, steerable airships one after another, and he flew them right over the rooftops of Paris like other men drove a carriage. He'd fly one of his airships down to his favorite restaurant, tie it off to a lamppost, and go in for lunch. I'm not making that up. The man treated the skies over Paris like his own front yard, and in 1901 he won the Deutsch Prize. Henri Deutsch de la Mertha, a wealthy oil man, had put up 100,000 francs for the first person who could fly an airship from the Aero Club field at St. Cloud around the Eiffel Tower and back in under 30 minutes. Round trip, about 7 miles, and you had to round that tower like a pylon. Santos Dumont went after it in his airship number 6. First attempt, his engine quit and he ended up draped over the trees. He rebuilt, went again. And this time he rounded the tower and came back, and there was an argument, if you can believe it, over whether he'd made the time. Because the rules said the clock stopped when the airship was moored, not when it crossed the line. Little bit of controversy, but the crowd wouldn't have it. Paris adored him. He got his prize, and here's the kind of man he was. He gave a big chunk of that prize money to the poor of Paris and split the rest among his mechanics. That was Santos Dumont. Generous, theatrical. A tiny man in beautiful clothes who flew over the most beautiful city on earth and waved at the crowds below. Now let me pause on one little detail, because pilots love this one. Flying those airships, Santos Dumont had a problem every one of us understands. He needed to know the time, and he needed both hands on the controls. Fishing a pocket watch out of your vest while you're trying to fly is a good way to end up in the trees, as he'd already learned. So he complained about it to his friend, a jeweler in Paris, fellow by the name of Louis Cartier. And Cartier built him a watch he could strap to his wrist, leather band, so he could read the time with both hands still flying. Now, men did not wear wristwatches in 1904. That was considered a ladies' thing, but Santos Dumont was famous, and Santos Dumont was a trendsetter, and when he started wearing that watch everywhere, well, that's the Cartier Santos. It's still made today. the pilot's wristwatch, worn because an aviator needed to keep his hands on the airship. Every one of you wearing a watch right now traces a little piece of that back to a Brazilian in a wicker basket over Paris. But airships weren't the future, and Alberto knew it. The future was heavier than air, wings.
So he set out to build an airplane, and in 1906, he rolled out the machine I described to you at the start. He called it the 14 bis. Bis is just French for a repeat and encore, because he'd originally slung it under one of his airships, number 14, to test it. The 14 bis, and she was a peculiar bird. She was what we'd call a canard today, meaning the little control surface, the elevator, was way out front on a long boom ahead of the pilot instead of behind him. The wings were set well back, big box kite cells with a pronounced dihedral, that upward V you see, folded like a bird tucking its wings. Alberto stood upright in a basket between the wings, and behind him, an Antoinette engine, about 50 horsepower, driving a pusher propeller. It was ungainly. It was fragile, and it flew backward from everything your instincts tell you, but it flew. Now close your eyes and come out to that field at Bagatelle with me. It's cold. The Antoinette fires up behind him, and if you've never heard one, it's a hard rattling bark, raw and mechanical, spitting a little oil, the whole airframe trembling on those bicycle wheels. The bamboo creaks, the wires hum. The crowd goes quiet, and Santos Dumont opens her up, and the 14 bis lumbers across the grass, bouncing, and then the nose comes up, and those wheels come off the earth. He flew about 60 meters, call it 200 feet, maybe 10 feet off the ground, for a handful of seconds. Doesn't sound like much, does it? 200 feet. You'd taxi that far to the run-up area without thinking about it. But here's why it mattered. The Aero Club de France was there. Officials with stopwatches and measuring tapes. Witnesses by the hundreds. Newspapermen. And so, in front of all of Europe in broad daylight on a public field. Alberto Santos Dumont made what the record books recognized as the first officially witnessed, officially timed, powered flight in Europe. And a few weeks later, he stretched it out to more than 200 meters and won the Aero Club prize for the first flight over that distance. The Wrights had flown 3 years earlier, and they'd flown farther, and they'd flown better, with real control. And history has sorted all that out. I'm not here to take a thing away from Orville and Wilbur. They were first and they earned it, but they did it in private. Santos Dumont did it in public, with the officials watching and the clock running, and for a lot of Europeans, this was the moment flight became real. Not a rumor from America, a thing they saw with their own eyes on a Sunday afternoon. And that's a distinction worth sitting with. There's the achievement, and then there's the moment the world decides to believe it. Sometimes those aren't the same day, and sometimes they aren't even the same man. Now Santos Dumont wasn't finished, and this next part is my favorite, because it tells you everything about his heart. He kept building. And he came up with a little airplane he called the Demoiselle, the Damselfly. And she was tiny, a featherweight, bamboo and silk, a small engine, a machine so light and so simple that Alberto figured just about anybody with a workshop and a little nerve could build one. And so he did something that in that era of secretive inventors and patent lawyers and men guarding their designs like gold was almost unheard of. He gave the plans away free. Published them, put the drawings of the Demoiselle out into the world for anyone to build. No patents, no licensing, no lawyers. He wanted people to fly. He believed the airplane belonged to humanity, not to a bank account. He thought aviation was going to lift the whole world up, bring nations together, end the pettiness that started wars. Back when Avegas was cheap and airspace was free, there was a man who thought the sky ought to be free too, and he meant it enough to give away the store. Now I'll be straight with you because you deserve the whole story and not just the pretty parts. That dream broke his heart. Santos Dumont lived to see the airplane he loved turned into a weapon. He watched the machines he'd helped bring into the world go up over the trenches of the Great War, carrying bombs and machine guns. He'd believed flight would be the thing that ended war, and instead it became a new way to wage it. And the man who had waved at crowds from over the Eiffel Tower, the little dandy who gave away his airplane so the whole world could fly, sank into a deep and terrible depression. He was sick too, with multiple sclerosis, which took the strength from the body that had once stood upright in a wicker basket wrestling an airship over Paris. He went home to Brazil. And in 1932, in a hotel in a seaside town near Sao Paulo, with civil war breaking out around him and airplanes once again flying overhead, dropping bombs, Alberto Santos Dumont took his own life. He was 59 years old. I don't tell you that to end us on a sad note. I tell you because a man is the whole of his story, the joy and the grief both, and because the grief came from exactly the same place as the joy. He loved flight that much. He believed in it that much. when it disappointed him, it broke something in him that a smaller love never could have. And here's the thing you need to know about how his own people remember him. In Brazil, to this day, Santos Dumont is the father of aviation, not the Wrights. Alberto, there's an airport named for him right in the heart of Rio de Janeiro, sitting on the water where the seaplanes used to come and go. His face has been on the currency. His name is on schools and streets and monuments all over that country. Brazilians will tell you, with a great deal of warmth and not a little stubbornness, that their man flew a real airplane in front of witnesses, and that's their pioneer. And you're welcome to keep the bicycle mechanics. And you know what? Let them have it. There's plenty of glory to go around at the dawn of flight. The sky's big enough for the Wrights and for Santos Dumont both.
Because here's what the little Brazilian gives us, all these years later. Not just the first witnessed hop in Europe. Not just the wristwatch on your arm. He gives us the reminder that the people who first went up into the sky weren't grim, calculating men chasing a payday. Some of them were dreamers in Panama hats who flew to lunch and tied off to a lamppost. Some of them gave the plans away because they thought you ought to be able to fly too. Some of them loved it so much it eventually cost them everything. Next time you strap in, next time you push the throttle up and feel the airplane come alive and get light on the wheels and lift off the earth, spare a thought for a 110-pound Brazilian standing upright in a basket over a Paris field, waving at a crowd that finally, finally believed. My thanks today to the good people at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, and to the historians at the Fédération Aéronautique Internationale, whose records keep the dates and the distances honest, and to the folks at Cartier, who've never once let anyone forget where that watch came from. You can find us anytime at radiohangar.com. This is Taildragger. Keep your dreams a little bigger than your fears, the way Alberto did. I'll see you next time.